Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, if you've got your Bibles with you this morning, I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball today. We're not going to be in Ephesians today, we're going to be in Psalms. So if you can find Psalm 20 this morning, that's where we're going to be at. Psalm chapter 20. I usually, for those of you who have been here for a while, and if you haven't been here for a while, that's quite all right too. We're glad you've been with us today. But I usually, when I start a series, I very, very, very rarely like to stop in the middle of it and go to something else, right? So I know Corona kind of changed that slightly. And we had to start our Ephesians series a little bit later. Thankfully, Pastor Joe and Pastor Jacob filled in those days. But today I really wanted to change gears a little bit this morning, because I read this verse that's on the screen. It's actually our memory verse for the month of November. And we're going to talk about it in depth here today. We're going to talk about the whole psalm. There's only 9 verses in this psalm. But I'm telling you, I read this verse this week. And then I was reading some commentary on this verse, and I'll give you the quote that I thought, man, I needed to hear that this week. And I felt like we needed to talk about it this week as well. Okay, so here's your memory verse for the month of November. We'll read it again in just a minute, but let's go ahead and say it now together. All right, you ready? I'll take that as a yes. Psalm 27. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Psalm 27. I always feel bad when you get to Psalms, it's like 27. You know, do you mean 27 or 20 verse 7? Anyway, I'm always confused by that. So forgive me if I run through the pause between the 20 and the 7 at some point in this month when our memory verse. All right. So Psalm 20, let's talk about it just for a minute we'll read it in just a second, but let's talk about it. Psalm 20 is a unique psalm. It says it's a psalm of David, but it's a unique psalm because in a lot of the psalms that David himself writes, or that are from David or for David, usually have a protagonist or a defined protagonist and antagonist. That means there's clearly someone causing the issue, and there's clearly David who is the one who's receiving the cause from the person. So you got the person over there who's bad, and they're doing something, and David is reacting to that. And he's reacting to that via writing the psalm, right? Today, you don't necessarily have clear-cut protagonist and antagonist. Now, you do have a little bit of the setting, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. So it's unique in the sense that there's not a defined bad and a defined good, necessarily. Characters, at least, in the psalm. That's unique. Second thing that makes it unique is this is what commentators call a royal psalm, because it talks at the end about God save the king, basically, right? That's what it says kind of at the end. We'll read it. And so it's unique because the psalm is addressing God on behalf of the king. The interesting part is that David, it says that it's a psalm of David. So David, in some sense, was speaking to God about himself in the third person, right? Just a little odd, a little weird, like not normally how we talk, okay? So it's a little unique in that sense, in those two senses, that it's a kingly royal psalm, and there's no clear-cut good and bad guy in the psalm. Here's the other thing you need to note, and this is kind of the setting of the psalm. The setting of the psalm is that there's an impending battle either about to take place or they are in the midst of a battle. Because you'll see things like this mentioned, our memory verse, horses and chariots. You'll see other things about saving the king. You'll hear talk about enemies and all of this kind of stuff. And that setting creates the psalm, right? And what we'll see is in these first 5 verses, the psalm breaks down into 3 parts. You have verses 1-5, which are kind of the introductory part of it. Then you have verses 6, 7, and 8, which form the heart of the psalm. And then in verse 9, you have a closing where basically it says, O Lord, save the king. something, which we'll read in just a minute. Okay, so you have those three parts. So today when we talk about it, read through it, then we're going to talk about verses 1 through 5 kind of quickly, and then we're going to talk about 6, 7, and 8 more in depth, because that forms the heart of the psalm, and then we'll kind of draw in some application for us today. All right, is everybody ready? Here we go. Psalm 20, verse 1. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob protect you. May he send you help. Here we go. May he send you help from the sanctuary and give you support from Zion. May he remember all your offerings and regard with favor your burnt sacrifices. May he grant you your heart's desire and fulfill all your plans. May we shout for joy over your salvation, and in the name of the Lord, in the name of our God, set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. Verse 6. Now I know the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven and with saving might of his right hand. Verse 7. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. They collapse and fall, but we rise and stand upright. Verse 9. O Lord, save the king. May he answer us when we call. All right, so let's talk. Verses 1 through 5 form the introductory part of this psalm. And remember, the setting is there's about to be a battle or they're already in a battle. And it's like, oh man, we got to do something. The interesting part about 1 through 5 that you need to realize is the entire thing is in what I would call and what we would call a prayer. Right? Because what do you do? Come on. What do you do when it hits the fan in your life? Of all the things you might do or do, you should, and I should, and we should pray. That's what David does. David, and maybe some commentators say that this is kind of a David and all of Israel kind of gathered together. And what are they doing? They are praying to the Lord, and they ask for some variety of things, right? In your outline, it tells, I've got a few listed there. They ask for answer. Hey, answer us. Like, hey, don't just be silent, Lord. We need to hear from you, right? Help us. Remember. Grant or give us and fulfill, right? That's not too far off from what we would pray in a situation like that, right? We would pray, hey, Lord, hey, I'm in this situation in my life. I really need to hear from you today. Like, Lord, give me some direction. I know I've prayed those two things numerous times. Lord, give me an answer. Some of us have probably even prayed, God, show me a sign. Right? Lord, do this in my life. If you want me to do this thing over here. Right? And so David is doing what all of us ought to be doing who have a relationship with the Lord, as that is when we don't know what else to do, we should pray. And so David prays. And he prays verse 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And after that, things switch gears. And in verse 6, 7, and 8, you don't have a prayer, but you have a response. And that's where I want to spend the majority of our time this morning, right? So what we learned before we even get to the main points I want to make for you this morning is that when we spend significant time in prayer with the Lord, two things ought to be obvious when we exit that time of prayer. Number one, we ought to learn something about God. And number two, we ought to learn something about ourselves. And that's exactly what David shows us in verse 6 and then in verse 7 and 8. In verse 6, he learned something or he is reminded about something in relation to God's character. And in verses 7 and 8, he is reminded about what his reaction ought to be. Learn something about himself. Let's read verse 6 again. What does he say? After this time of prayer, David says, now I know. That phrase right there. Now I know. The image that those three words are trying to captivate, y'all ready for this? Is a wrestling match. A wrestling match. Do y'all remember the Old Testament story? If you don't, it's in Genesis. You can go back and Google it later today and read it, where Jacob wrestles with God. If you haven't read that story, it's an amazing story. And Jacob and God wrestle. Now you say, Pastor, how did Jacob wrestle with God? I have no idea. I've wondered that since I was in the ninth grade and was on the Warner Arms High School wrestling team. I mean, was they like jujitsuing each other out there? Like, what was going on? Was it bear hugs? I mean, come on. Were they trying to like cross body toss each other? I mean, hello. How do you wrestle with God? I've always wondered that. Not that it really matters, but it has like plagued my mind since ninth grade, Warner Robins High School. Like, how do you wrestle with God? Would I want to wrestle with? Do you want to wrestle with God? I don't know. What does it mean? But the Bible tells us that Jacob wrestled with God and they struggled and they fought. And Jacob at the end says, hey, Lord, don't let me go until you bless me. And he blesses him and all that. This little phrase, now I know, it's trying to capture that idea where David has wrestled with God, whatever that means, in a time of prayer. And now that he's come out of that time of prayer, that phrase, now I know, means that I am thoroughly convinced. Not just an intellectual knowledge like you know math facts and multiplication tables, but a firm, committed belief in something. And so what is David convinced of? David is convinced that the Lord saves his anointed, right? Let's go back. So now I know I'm thoroughly convinced. I've been in this time. I've wrestled with this issue and I've come out of this issue because we've got an impending engagement coming up. And I am thoroughly convinced that what is the Lord going to do? The Lord saves. Now that phrase right there means that the Lord will save even though the opportunity for him to do it hasn't even come up yet. So what is David convinced of? David is convinced that when the battle happens, the Lord will save his anointed even though the battle has yet to happen. So David is convinced now that in an hour or 2 hours or a day or whenever it is, that he's going to be saved. And he is thoroughly convinced now of what God's going to do in the future. Right? And then he says, now the Lord will save his anointed. Now don't get thrown off by that. Anointed just means a person who has been chosen by God for a specific purpose. In the Old Testament setting, it's usually referred to the king. And it's usually when Samuel anointed David's head with oil, and that shows God's called him for a special purpose, for a special reason. Right? Jesus also picks up this title in the New Testament, God's Messiah, which means anointed one, right? And so if we're extrapolating that out of the New Testament, we would see Jesus could be that. We can even, as we'll see in a minute, you could extrapolate that out to me and you, right? Because has God not called you for a special purpose? I think so. But in this setting, David is saying, I know God has called me for a special purpose. Like, I know I'm the king. God's called me for a special purpose. And I am thoroughly convinced that even though the battle hasn't happened yet, we're going to win. And God's going to save all of us, right? And then he goes on and on and on. So he learned something about God. His time of prayer reminds him that God will save his people. Now, that's not the only thing. Now, that would be great and that would be grand. But the part that captured my heart this week and where we're going to lean into a minute in application is verse number 7. Because David not only learned something about God, but he learns about what his reaction to God ought to be. It says, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will trust in the name of the Lord our God. I was reading a commentary, and this is what, man, blew me away. I was reading a commentary this week by Gerald Wilson, NIV Application Commentary. If you want to look it up, it's a great book. A great book on the Psalms. And Gerald Wilson said that chariots, specifically chariots and horses together, because horses pull the chariots, right? They were the greatest, best, and most efficient military item that culture had to offer. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. By the time David wrote this psalm, right? Chariots, specifically chariots, were the premier weapon on the battlefield. David occurs, just for some of you who are history people, David occurs, he lives around 1000 BC, which is the transition out of the Bronze Age and into the Iron Age in Israel. And David, about the time that David comes into power in Israel, chariots come in three forms. Aren't you ready? First, there's the light chariot. That's two horses, or a horse, or two horses, a driver, and a bow person. And the archer would have quivers, that's it, quivers, on four positions in the chariot. So there'd be one on the right corner, left corner, front, and then one on the back. And the archer, and the driver would drive up, and they would run close to the line, and the archer would take his, so if I'm going this way, the driver's going this way, and I'm shooting arrows, I can go boom, 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 and when I get past you, I can pull out the back, boom, 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 and it's fast. But by the time David comes up, you've not only have light chariots, you also have heavy chariots, which are bigger, have four horses with 3 to 4 people in it. So what's that mean? One driver, 3 archers, maybe somebody with a spear, maybe someone with some other type tools, right? And then the worst of all of them was the Scythian or the scythed chariot, which was like a medium-sized chariot in between the two that was had a driver, had an archer, but on the spokes of the wheel, it had like metal swords like this long. Yeah. You know what that one was for? If you're in a battle line, just like Israel would have been in, because you have an infantry-based army like Israel had. You're in a battle line and you have all of these Scythian chariots, right, who are riding. You know what they do? There's no archery's just there for fun and kicks and giggles, because what they're going to do with that chariot is they're literally going to run it straight through your line, and all of those side swords are going to cut people off at the hip. And then because you've created this wedge in the middle, then your infantry, which is behind, can run right in the line, and you've basically cut the army in half. Pretty wow, right? Pretty devastating. Can you imagine if you're Israel and you're standing over there with your little spear, your little hide shield, maybe with a little bit of bronze on it, and you're looking at, and there's like a few hundred chariots coming your way? Some trust in chariots and some in horses. Lord, can you send us a few? Because see, at this time, listen, let me ask you a question. How many chariots did Israel take out of Egypt? Oh, you want to know the answer? 0. Let me ask you a question. When Israel crossed the Red Sea, whose chariots and horses died in the Red Sea? Egyptians. Do you know what Moses tells Israel in Deuteronomy 17? You can go back and read it. We don't have it on the screen. You can go back and read it. Do you know what Deuteronomy 17, Moses, God speaking through Moses, specifically tells the people of Israel before they enter the promised land that there's 2 things the king shouldn't do? He should not have many horses, and he should not send the people of Israel back to Egypt to get chariots. Israel had no horses. Think about this. In all of the stories you've ever heard about David, did you ever hear of David riding a horse? Nope. Why? Because God's army, Israel's army, God's people, were an infantry-based, spear and shield-based army. So at this point, they have 2 choices. We're either going to trust in chariots or horses, or we're going to trust in God. You say, why does all this matter? Like, what? Why are we talking about Israel military technique and all of that? Because we're not in a battle, and like, you ever seen a chariot riding down the road lately? No, I haven't either. The point of all this is that time in prayer with God for this specific scenario was to refocus their attention on priority and perspective. And their priority wasn't on trusting in the latest and greatest that culture had to offer, but the perspective of the battle and the engagement should have been from God's perspective. Because see, if you think about all of this from God's perspective, God has already shown himself to be faithful in every engagement in which Israel fully trusted in him. Let's think of a few. We've already mentioned one, the Red Sea. How about Jericho? How much military genius does it take? Or is anybody going to say, hey, let's capture this city by walking around and yelling a lot? That makes a lot of sense. But what happened? We all know the song as we learned in Vacation Bible School, the walls come tumbling down. Walls come tumbling down. Right. I'll let y'all sing that later. Right? And then what about all the other battles? You can go read the book of Joshua. God shows himself faithful, and even in David's life, faithful and faithful and faithful when his people trust in him. Right? When they don't trust in him, like at the battle of Ai, things go horribly wrong. But when God's people look at it from his priority and his perspective, what happens? The Lord saves his anointed, right? You say, well, what does this have to do with me? What does this have to do with us today? I think it has a lot to do with us. We don't have horses and chariots. Well, some of you have horses, but many of you don't have, I don't know anybody has a chariot. I don't know that anybody's going to go, you know, on election day and ride around and shoot arrows at people. Like, that's, you'd go to jail for that, rightfully so, right? You may want to, but don't do that. It's not a good idea, right? But here's the thing. Here's the thing. Listen to me. Listen to me. Here's the line I think we need to look at. Jared Wilson says, horses and chariots represent the greatest, best, most efficient, premier thing that culture had to offer. So we don't have horses and chariots. But man, if we're not careful, we have a lot of things that are the best, greatest, and most that culture has to offer that we are very quick to put our trust in. Right? Let's think about a few. I got three for you this morning. We could probably think of 100, but I got three. Number one, if we're not careful, and listen to me, I'm not saying any of these things I mentioned, I'm not saying they're bad, okay? I'm just saying you got to be careful. Is a chariot bad? No, it's not bad. But when you trust, putting your trust in something over God, that's when it's bad. So, like, you know, some people put a lot of their trust in like the stock market, right? That's not a bad thing. Like, I have money in the stock market because eventually one day, you know, like when I'm 82, I'd like to retire. One day, maybe, you know, it's not bad. But listen, folks, if you put all of your trust in your 401k and your all the stuff that's going to happen on, how you think that worked out for some of y'all in 2008 and 9? It didn't. Hey, look, how you think that worked out for your grandparents, your great-grandparents during the Depression? Didn't work out too good, did it? My point is that if you put your trust in materials and money and stock markets and bank accounts and all that, eventually one day that's not going to be what holds you up. I've heard countless story after story after story after story, and this blows my mind because I ain't one of these people. I probably will never be one of these people, but I've heard countless stories over and over again about people who are the most wealthy in the world are the most lonely and depressed and still looking for fulfillment in the world. Why? Because their trust is in their money, not in the only one who can fulfill them, which is the Lord, right? Here's another thing we put our trust in. Technology. Technology, right? Man, look, we live, I would argue that we live in one of the greatest times to ever be alive. You want to know why? Because one, when it gets cold this winter, I have HVAC. Prayerfully, that will work. Right? You know why? It's one of the, Mr. Sonny tells one of the real, but one of the funniest stories to me because it's so outside of my worldview. He said one time when he was a kid, things got so bad they had to eat all the chickens and they had rocks for Easter eggs, right? Am I right?
Right.
That sounds like bizarre and crazy to me, right? You want to know why? Because when I get hungry, we can go to Walmart, right? Well, yeah, man, you don't even have to go into Walmart anymore. You can click list on Kroger, or you can do pickup, and folks in the Walmart will go get all of your groceries for you, and then you just punch a button and say, I'm here, and they bring them out to you. You can order literally anything on Amazon. Just this week, I was looking for a part. Holly's dad gave us a golf cart. It's not running yet, but I've ordered 3 electrical components, and now, guess what? I found an oil filter for a 1999 EasyGo golf cart on Amazon. We ordered Halloween outfits on Amazon. I mean, this is crazy. And all you have to do, and you can get a lot of it in 2 days. 2 days. Blows my mind. But here's the problem. If we put all of our trust in technology, here's what happens. We begin to put everything in our existence and who we are is tied up in what everybody else says about our life, right? And I don't have my phone with me because this is being used to be recorded. But how many of us, or how many, and maybe you know some people like this, maybe this is you, so I don't know, like, but if your only stuff on social media is pictures of you, that may not be the best thing. Like if you by yourself doing, like that may not be the best thing. Because my question for you is, why do you feel the need to post photos of selfies of you? Beyond that, why do you post pictures of you that everyone knows aren't really what you look like because you've highly filtered the picture? Do you not do you not like the way you look? Do you want us to be like faked out when we look at you and be like, whoa, that's awesome. But that's not really you. It's a filtered version of you. And then, hey, all of us suffer from this. When we post a picture and it automatically comes back up on our feed, and when that few people haven't hearted, liked it, or retweeted, or done whatever, and we instantly think, why didn't they do that with my post? Because we're trying to gain who we are from what people who we may or might not even really be friends with say about us. That's ridiculous. Like, why do you care? Why do you care? Why do we care? Why does culture care that a filtered picture is better than the real picture? Right? That's crazy. Crazy. Funny story real quick, and then I'll get back. So I heard Creflo Dollar several years ago, and I don't like... Preface what I don't agree with Creflo Dollar, and anyway, but he was talking to young men and young women, right? And so that's y'all today. Sorry, that's y'all. So he was talking to young men and women. He was talking about marriage and relationships, and he said, hey, you know what, guys, you need to see what your partner, whoever you're dating or whatever, what they look like without makeup on. And I was like, it's a great idea. You know when, I've thought about this a while, but you want to know when Holly and I realized, hey, she's the one. It wasn't by her filtered Facebook picture, but it was when me and her went riding four-wheelers and literally got caked with mud. Why? Because that was like real life. It wasn't a filtered version. We literally had mud everywhere. And we came back and we washed off, and I was like, she's cool. Like, I like her a lot, right? It wasn't because I saw some filtered version of her on Facebook. We didn't even have Facebook back then. But it wasn't because I saw some highly edited version of her picture. But because I saw the real her, right? Which is riding foilers in the mud, right? And that wasn't fake. That was real. And so what I'm trying to say is, when we put all of our trust in technology, what happens when technology doesn't work? I mean, have you heard some of the things they're trying? Self-driving cars. Now, that may be better for some of y'all, right? I mean, just saying, right? But what happens when you get in an accident with another self-driving car? Whose fault is it? It wasn't mine. I was taking a nap. Well, it wasn't mine. The 7G internet went down. Well, that ain't my fault. That's yours. Whose fault is it? Right? Have you heard about this thing called a neural link? Y'all heard about that? You hadn't Google it, but it'll blow your mind. You know what they're trying to do? They're trying to link like the internet to your brain. It's serious. Like, this isn't like some sci-fi hocus pocus stuff. Like Neuralink, trying to like link your phone and all that to your brain. And so what happens when they program stuff and you do stuff you didn't want to do? My Neuralink caused me to do this. Really? No, you did it. No, but it was my neural. I mean, that sounds great, right? Like you could order something on Amazon without even having to go on your phone. You just think about, hey, I need to order that Halloween costume. And phew, there it is, 2 days away. That's crazy. Until it's not, until the person who's behind, it's like the Wizard of Oz, right? Until you see who's behind the screen and it's not the person you really like, right? So technology's great till it's not. And if we put all of our trust in technology, what's going to happen when it doesn't work the way we want it to? Or you watch the program like The Social Dilemma. If you haven't watched that, you need to watch that. It'll blow your mind. Right? Technology's great, but if we put all of our trust in technology, where does it take us? It doesn't take us necessarily toward God. It probably takes us further away. Here's a big one. And I'm going to throw this one, this grenade in the room and just like let it sit. Right? Some of us are putting a lot of faith and trust in what's going to happen on Tuesday. I voted. I got the sticker. Not the sticker I wanted. I wanted the Peach State sticker, and she gave me the other one. I was a little mad about that. That's my problem, right? So, I voted. I've already voted. I voted last week. It was great. Went through like 25 minutes, cast all my ballots. Good. Got it. But here's the reality. If we're putting all of our faith and trust that one candidate or another might win on Tuesday, if what happens if or that person wins or doesn't win, but yet things still don't work out the way you want them to work out? Trust is only as good, listen to me, trust is only as good as what you put your trust in. Right? Trust that X, Y, or Z person is going to do what they say they're going to do is only as good as that person's word. And so if we're putting all of this trust in what's going to happen on Tuesday, the reality is whatever happens, something along the way is not going to happen the way you and I want it to happen. And here's the reality. Here's the sobering part. God already knows who's going to win. And whoever wins, God allowed that person to win. Whether it's the person you voted for or I voted for, or whether it's the person I voted for, but then we had voter fraud and the mail-in ballots are counted and the other person wins. God still knew all of that was going to happen. And he allowed it to happen. And so at this point in our life, we've got to do what David says here. We've got to either trust in, you know, not charity, we've got to either, you're either going to trust in elections and government and technology and stock markets and all this, or you're going to trust in God. You're going to trust in the best that culture has to offer, or you're going to trust in God. And that's where we're at today. Who are you going to place your trust in? Your trust is only as good as that which you place it in. So where are you going to place it? You're going to place it in the best culture has to offer, or are you going to place it in God? Because as we all know, the best culture has to offer changes very rapidly. And in 6 months, the best culture has to offer will be something completely different than what it is today. And if you're trusting in that, you better change quick, or you're going to be the outcast. Or are you going to trust in God who never changes, who's the same yesterday, today, and forever, who sent his only son Jesus to die on the cross to rise again so that we might have life and have it more abundantly? And that's your two choices. So I wish I could choose for you, but I can't. So we each have to choose individually who we are going to place our trust in. And for some of us, and on some days, that is a minute by minute thing. And guess what? That's okay, right? So who are you and I going to put our trust in? All right? Pray with me. Lord, thank you so much for this day. Thank you that you are trustworthy. Lord, that you are worthy of our trust, that you are worthy of our adoration and praise. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to place our trust in you. Lord, there's a lot that culture has to offer. And frankly, a lot of it is pretty good. But at the end of the day, Lord, you're the only one who is supremely worthy of our adoration and trust. Because you will never fail us. You will never let us down. You will never let us go. And so, Lord, I pray that we would choose today to put all of our trust and all of our faith and all of our hope in you, just as David did in this psalm. In your name we pray. Amen. Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.